Welcome to the Unblocking Crypto Podcast. This podcast is not financial advice. It's meant for entertainment purposes only. These are just the opinions of a couple of rambling wrecks.
Welcome back to episode 159 of Unblocking Crypto. Hal, great to see you as always.
Good to see you, Jason.
This week's going to be a little bit different. We've been talking about the Bitcoin Standard book for a little while now and thought it'd be kind of interesting to kind of do a book review. Right? We kind of joked that we probably haven't done one of these since school and many, many, many years ago. So not really sure how this is going to go, but I think it'll be an interesting thing for most people to hear just because it provides a ton of history on what fiat is and what Bitcoin is and how the two of them are going to kind of relate to each other moving forward. So I'm going to toss it over to you and let you get started from your perspective, and I'll kind of jump in where I see fit.
Yeah. So the reason that I picked this book up was, you know, years ago, it was just on a list of must read books for Bitcoin education kind of thing. And so, yeah, well, so I read it long enough ago that I had to reread it, like do a speed run so that I could talk about it in this call, actually. So I have a notebook that's dedicated specifically for books that I don't want to read twice. But I know they're going to have a lot of good nuggets in there. And I can't find that notebook, so I had to reread the whole book. So, like, you know, it's great to write things down, but you also have to keep track of stuff. So, but I remember reading the first time and being shocked about how little it talked about Bitcoin. Like, I bought the book because it must have been the 2020 bull run. I'm juiced up about Bitcoin, and I'm reading this book and I'm like, wait, get to the Bitcoin stuff, right? Because the first two thirds of the book probably walk you through the history of money. And it's basically anecdotes, and it's a history lesson of going from the barter system and explaining the coincidence of wants. Like, if you have bananas and somebody else has apples, then it works out great if you want an apple and they want a banana and you can make a trade. But if you want something else, then it doesn't work. And so that's how money evolved. And basically it's a good that's only good for exchanging things. So it's not something that it's just the medium between two people. And its best value is the fact that everybody values it. So that it doesn't matter if you want an apple or an orange or a car or a house or lunch. Everybody wants it, so you can kind of trade out of your apple and into your lunch. And further, you can trade your time and skills for that money and then hold it so that later you can get the apples or bananas or cars or houses that you want. And so like that basis of money, it sounds super simple to me because honestly, through this whole Bitcoin education, I've really picked up on money and I've read these things and understand them in and out. But it didn't 10 years ago. I would have been like, oh, okay, interesting. You know, yes, I kind of feel that that's why I work to make dollars. And then I turn those dollars into things that I want today and I save the dollars that I want to buy things tomorrow. But I never really kind of thought about it as, you know, this thing that everyone has to value so that we can trade and not have to deal with, hey, well, would you want this or that? And now I got to go find a third party that has an item that the person that holds the thing that I want. So it simplifies everything. It reduces the friction of transactions. It opens up trade. Like, it's hugely valuable. And it basically, but for humans to flourish, it had to evolve. And so different places had different things, beads, shells, stones, it's cattle, you know, all these different things. And it talked about how the colonizers came over, or it was a community was exposed to an outside community and they were trading stones or beads, the outside community would be like, okay, great. And then they would go out into the world and find more stones and beads and basically inflate their currency and wreck their money, where the money would work great if everything stayed the same for that community, but that outside influence. And then that's kind of how they eventually move into the metal monies. silver and gold, and how, you know, gold, you can't really fake it. You can, but it's a difficult thing to do. And if you mint it into coins and all the different flaws of that. So, but gold is an interesting one, because universally across different communities and different geographies, gold emerged as this valued metal. And so there's just something about humans that like gold, effectively. And that allowed everyone to trade. So like the Aztecs and the Egyptians could have traded if they could have met each other, because they both valued gold. And so for me, it's like this interesting thing where that money just emerged because of the way humans think, and it's something innate or something in built in. And so for me, that's kind of how you get from the beginning of the book into like, hey, over thousands of years, gold emerged as the best money that was available, you know, from, you know, the beginning of man until something like modern history. And I thought that was pretty neat, because everybody knows gold's neat. Like, I grew up and it's like gold jewelry, you know, it's gold's valuable. And there's a bunch of like the golden rule, you know, and you get gold pops up a lot when you're growing up. And so it's like this thing that everyone values. So to me, that's the quickest I could talk about going from early man to, let's say, the gold standard and people using gold. And like, it talked a lot about the Roman times where, you know, they had the denarii and they kept inflating it. And that was how it influenced the fall of Rome, because they eventually, soldiers just didn't want to fight for gold that kept falling apart. Like it became not worth it to them. And so that's kind of an interesting piece, right? They talked about all these different big civilizations that when they lost the money, they lost the empire. And, you know, to me, Saifedean Amos, the author, you know, he looks at everything through this lens, right? He's the mechanical engineer turned economist. And so there are other things that influence the fall of Rome, but if you're looking at it through this lens, it's pretty easy to see that it was a huge contributing factor into their inability to keep things together.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I took out of this, that there's almost like three functions of money, right? You talked about the medium of exchange, there's the unit of account, and the big thing is the store of value. And it wasn't really until gold where this store of value really kind of caught on, because it was hard to get more gold. Like you talked about with the seashells and the rocks and everything like that, people could go find more rocks and seashells, and all of a sudden it wrecked those economies. With gold, that wasn't really the case. And if you look at the history of gold, it's pretty much steadily increased over its history. It hasn't had these huge finds that have created a ton more of it. So that's what probably the one thing that's been missing over something that's lasted for so long, is that true store of account where it doesn't lose value over time.
Right. And that's where, you know, Saifedean, through his economist lens, was like, when we were on the gold standard, we being humans, not me and you, but when we were on, we've never been, we're not old enough, but the amount of flourishing and innovation, and, you know, everyone could do long-term projects, and mm-hmm. they valued things in a longer scale. And he, I don't know if he coins the terms low time preference and high time preference, or if that's borrowed from previous economists, but the low time preference, meaning you have less preference for time, so you can do longer term things, you're more focused on a long-term scale. If your money doesn't fall apart on you, then you can hold on to it for years or decades or to the next generation and be comfortable with it. And then on the flip side, with high time preference, as you go into fiat money and you lose the gold standard, your money isn't backed by gold, then your money's inflating away. So if you're Zimbabwean and you get paid in the morning, but by next week it's worth 75% of what you got, you're looking to spend it as fast as possible, because your money rots faster than the produce that you buy at the market, right? So you have a high time preference. It's all about like now. And so that to me was interesting because, you know, in our lifetime, it's always been post gold standard, and you can kind of feel it. Like houses are built quick and cheap, and it's not like there's very rarely a house built where it's like, oh, we pulled the marble from here and we did this, and this house is going to stand for 200 years. Like, no, this is what we wanted, so we built it. And, or we saw this plan in a magazine and we got the cheapest bidder to build it, and now here's our house. And so I find that the low and high time preference is interesting. And I teach my kids about it. Like when I talk to them about Bitcoin and run through some, like the Bitcoin curriculum that's done by My First Bitcoin or Me Premier Bitcoin from El Salvador, it jumps right into high and low time preference quickly. And I think kids need to understand that you need to have high and low time preference, and you need to understand when you have one or the other. I mean, like if I'm working on a project and it's a weirdo project, I need a weirdo tool that I'm never going to use again, I go to Harbor Freight. But if I need a tool that I'm going to use over and over and over again over a long period of time, then I'm going to get a more high quality tool that's going to last a lot longer. And so that awareness is pretty useful, I think, because there's some items that's like, you know what, this one, I just need this right now, and I don't care if I have it in the future. And some items like, man, this is, I want to buy one cast iron skillet, and I never want to buy another one. And so let me get the best one I can buy. And so that, I think that from if you look at this book in two different ways, one as a Bitcoin education book, and two is like a personal development book, understanding high and low time preference, I think is something super valuable you can pull out of this and apply it to your life. Because, you know, I always said when I'm in business, I told people I play long-term games with long-term people. I'm not going in and trying to sell something and screw somebody and move on, and that guy's never going to buy anything from me again. I have a financial advisor who's my age, whose in-laws and his parents live in my town. He's not moving. I'm not going to have to get another financial advisor. You know, prior to this, I had a buddy of mine who was a financial advisor when I was in college. He moved to another company. I got another guy. He moved. I got another guy. So like every 4 to 5 years, I'm getting a new financial advisor. And I'm like, this sucks, man. I don't want to keep it. Hey, yeah, my name's Hal. I like to take risks. I do this. It's kind of funky. You know, it's like a hard, long thing to explain how I handle stuff. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to have one guy. And so I've got rental properties, my property manager. He's younger than me. He owns his own business. He and his wife, his parents and their in-laws all live in my same town. He's not moving, right? So I'm not going to have to find another property manager. And so these are all low time preference decisions, because these are long time projects that I have. I'm going to have money for as long as I live. My plan was to have rental properties for as long as I live. However, with Bitcoin and everything, I'm not so sure that I'm going to. I'll go off on a tangent here because I just sold a rental property and got into a Bitcoin adjacent investment because I have real estate and all I want it to do is provide me cash flow. That's it. Fund it pays for the lifestyle for me and the family. It pays the bills. And then I have Bitcoin and I buy Bitcoin and it's a black hole and the value goes up, but I never pull any value out. I never spend any of it. And so I'm like, okay, I in my head, I have to psychologically put Bitcoin in one bucket and real estate in another, and the real estate cash flows and it prevents me from spending my Bitcoin. So I've always kind of, that's how I've defended the fact that I still hold real estate, even though it's not as good as Bitcoin as an investment. So what I do is like, okay, this is paying all the bills and I don't want to touch my Bitcoin. That's what made real estate valuable in my mind, is that it was the first line of defense against the Bitcoin. And then the MicroStrategy volatility comes around and I'm looking at covered call strategies to generate cash flow and MSTY. And when I sold some duplexes and had some cash, I'm like, this investment is right in between real estate and Bitcoin for me. It's got Bitcoin upside and Bitcoin exposure, but it cash flows like real estate. And so that's why I'm like, okay, I'm going to take I'm my first line of defense. I'm going to peel back a little bit and move it closer to the more valuable money. Right. So that's kind of what this book talks about, is the more valuable money always wins. The people that hold the weaker money eventually flow up to the stronger money. And there's usually one money that wins, and it has been gold. So, I mean, I'm kind of living that in this trade that I just did this month, because I view real estate as money. I even think I used to think as a unit of account, like, okay, well, here's our profit for this. This is a rental house, or this is two rental houses. And so, you know, I'm not thinking, oh, this is X number of dollars. I'm like, oh, I could buy a rental house with this. So, you know, I kind of have been floating around with changing my unit of account pretty quickly. Now, value of real estate's changed so much in the last 4 or 5 years that it's hard to, you know, the price of a rental house is tough to nail. It used to be pretty easy. Like, there would be anything between, you know, just say $75,000. There was a house somewhere you could buy and fix for $75,000 that would rent and be in a good enough startup neighborhood. Now, that's not the case. Like, $200,000 is like the cheapest house out there now. That's you know, you could rent and expect to have tenants that don't destroy your stuff. And so, you know, my unit of account's totally changed on the real estate side. But I haven't bought a rental property in a while, because one, there's no deals, because the real estate market's gone insane when they went with low interest rates and all that. And so that's when I started picking up more Bitcoin. But I mean, it is kind of how the book talks about the weaker money loses to the stronger money. Bitcoin is the stronger money. And in my short 7 years of understanding Bitcoin, my money is flowing from other assets up into Bitcoin.
Well, I think that makes sense, because one of the things that you look at money from a perspective of what makes it stronger versus weaker, there's probably three levels of saleability that you can look at. And one is that money saleable across scales, right? So can you use it to buy an apple and a car at the same time, and not have to, I mean, if you only have one thing like gold, I mean, you can use it for both. It's just a little bit more complicated, whereas something like a Bitcoin is divisible into 100 million Satoshis, right? Making sure it's saleable across space, going from one location to another, is sometimes very difficult. And something like gold costs a lot of money to transfer. Something like a car costs a lot of money to transfer. Cash is somewhat easy sometimes. And then the other big thing is across time. And like what you talked about earlier was Zimbabwe had an incredibly bad time where their dollar was being losing value overnight, right? So gold has historically been one of the few things out there that hasn't lost its spending value long term. The value of a dollar, you look at it from what, the early 1900s, it's lost 99% of its value since then, right? So and almost everything compared to Bitcoin has lost 99% of its value over the past 15 years too. So those are the three ways you look at it and say, okay, if you can meet those three saleability levels, then that makes you a much stronger currency than something else, Tim.
Yeah. And, you know, in the book talked about this gold standard and how strong it was. You know, it said Britain was on the gold standard from the early 1700s until the start of World War One. So that's 200 years of a gold standard, like the same money. Everybody knows what's going on. And not only that, the difference between the 1700s and the 1900s from a technology standpoint is insane. You know, it's pre the United States. The United States was a colony when this started, and the United States is a powerhouse going into World War One. And globally, we're trading using gold as the medium exchange on a large scale for goods and services across countries. And so that's like where Saifedean proves that the gold standard worked, right? I mean, you're talking about thousands of years of humans and 200 years of, you know, a singular country, Britain, which went from a powerful country to a very ordinary country in that 200 years, not because of gold. Just, I mean, honestly, I guess if you compared Britain to other European countries, it's probably doing fine. But if you compare it to the United States in that same 200 year span, the United States went from nothing to really the number one country in the world. And, you know, to me, this is where I think about money and war, because the book goes into how the world started to come off of the gold standard due to war. And, you know, basically, if you're on a gold standard, your government is locked in to how they can only spend what they have, because the gold has to be there. They can't fake the gold. And this is even kind of hard to think about, because I've never lived in a world where the government's restricted by how much gold they have, or restricted by anything, because they can print their way out of it. And so for this, you know, you go into World War One, they have to pause the gold standard so they can print money. Otherwise, you know, when I was growing up, I heard about war bonds, you know, like people would buy war bonds. That's the government raising money from its citizens to pay for tanks and bombs. Like, that thought is so weird to me, because I've never, like, the government's always just printed money to do that. It's never asked me, like, hey, if you paid your taxes, great, we need to go to war because so-and-so's acting up and they're going to take over the world if we don't. We need, you know, this is everybody, all hands on deck, and we need more money. And then people would pay the government more money to build tanks and bombs and stuff like that. That's a crazy thought, but that's what they had to do, because they had to have the money in the bank in order to spend it. There was no government credit card. There is no, we'll pay it back later. There's no, they had to raise the money, or they had to have the money. And so, you know, basically governments were wildly motivated to get off the gold standard. And it kind of chopped around World War One, and then there's the Bretton Woods Agreement. They created the IMF, and then central banks colluded to get some exchange rate stability, right? So, like, that was, to me, kind of an interesting piece, because you went from this gold standard, and the gold kind of worked as this intermediary between all these different currencies. And, you know, if you had US dollars and pounds from the UK, you could trade in gold, and gold had as its exchange rate in both currencies. And then the IMF comes in, and they establish exchange rates and keep them stable from, like, a centralized way, right? So gold was a decentralized exchange rate stabilizer. And in the same way that if you want an apple or an orange or a banana, you know, you go up into gold and then back down into the banana. Here, you go out of the dollar, up into gold, back down into the pound. So, you know, to me, Seyfeddin's walking you through money as this medium of exchange, and then gold is the best one. It works globally between countries, and governments didn't choose gold, but governments did choose the IMF to be this controlling factor. So now, instead of going out of dollars, up into gold, down into pounds, you could go dollars to pounds. There was just an exchange rate between the two currencies. And so, go ahead.
And I would say, I don't remember the exact amount, but, like, all these currencies, these fiat currencies, used to be tied directly to, like, almost a certain amount of ounces of gold. So the sterling pound had a whatever, the 0.6 ounces of gold, and the Swedish, or Switzerland's, was it franc, whatever they call theirs, they were tied to a certain amount of gold. And so it was almost easy to do. And then that almost kind of disappeared.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what happens. Like, the government screws things up. Right. I mean, you see it all the time. And so that's what they did. And, like, to me, this is, like, I mean, we're deep into the book by the time we get to Nixon coming off of the gold standard in 1971. And that was, like, the nail in the coffin for gold as a global medium of exchange, and, you know, taking the world off of the gold standard, because now it's the U.S. has control, because after World War II, the U.S. basically bailed out every other country who was wrecked, but the U.S. was strong. And so that's when we set up the petrodollar. And so all oil sold in U.S. dollars. And so that's when the U.S. really took over as post-World War II. But as the global power and basically the bank for the world, on a gold standard, you're really limited. And so, to me, you know, 1971, Nixon, we're in an unpopular war, and the government's kind of getting bloated, and they need to do stuff that the citizens don't want to do, and they can't raise war bonds because it's not a popular enough war, and that would expose how unpopular it was. And so, hey, we're going to pause the gold standard here temporarily, and we're going to be able to print money. And that's been temporary now from 1971 to 2025. So we're talking, you know, almost 54 years of temporary gold standard pause. That the crooked, you know, the government's just constantly making crooked moves. And so this is one of them.
I think interesting thing to look at for people that are interested in knowing more about that piece of it is WTF happened in 1971.com. Ton of data and a ton of things to look through and see what changed. And it's kind of eye-opening and kind of scary at the same time.
Yeah, there's actually a chart in this book about the commodities priced in gold versus the dollar that goes back to 1792. And the gold and dollar chart, there's variability, but they pretty much follow each other along. And then in 1971, they split and the commodities priced in dollars starts to move up at like a 45 degree angle from 1971. He had until 2004. And the commodities priced in gold keeps kind of basically going along in the same path. So, it's not like the price of commodities in gold and the dollar was going up from 1792 to 1971. That was kind of flat. So, you know, you got to, you know, they're mining gold and there's more gold in the system, but, you know, there's technology making commodities cheaper. I mean, 1792 to 1971, you know, there's a big difference in the clothes you wear. There's a big difference in how you get your food. There's a big difference in, I mean, you have televisions in houses, and in 1792, you barely had houses. A lot of houses didn't have floors. They just used the dirt. So, I mean, you're talking about a huge improvement in quality of life with very little inflation as the cost of commodities in dollars and in dollars or gold. So you can see it that when you have sound money, and this is why a lot of these sound money economists are so adamant about it, that everybody's quality of life can improve and improve and improve. But if your great, 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 great grandfather buried the money that would be gold, underneath your dirt floor house, and in the 1970s when you built a new house, you dug it up and hit this treasure chest, it would be, your purchasing power would be the same from 1792 to 1970. So your quality of life, what you could buy with that gold, would be increased, but not because it gained value over things, but because it just broke even. He had a lot of gold back then, and now that gold can buy you a similar amount of things now. And that would not be the case if you buried dollar bills wrapped in Ziploc bags. You'd be like, oh, great. Thanks, great, great granddad. Here's $50. You know, it used to buy a year's worth of food, and now it'll buy two people lunch. So the difference. And that's why I think when I listen to people like Lawrence Lepard, you know, you can hear it in his voice a lot that he knows that it's just wrecking people. Like, this inflation is just slowly destroying people's ability to buy premium foods, and instead they're buying processed foods because they're cheaper and they're less healthy, but they're more affordable. And so, you know, this, you know, you're making people work and trade their lives away in order to get worse stuff in the future. And so I think this book does a pretty good job of laying the foundation for people to figure that out.
Yeah, it's almost maybe interesting, or introducing the concept of stock to flow at this point would be kind of intriguing, because in reality, the way to maintain value in money is limiting production. And with the governments just not limiting production and doing quite the opposite, that's what hurt the value in money, right? So when you have this, the stock is the amount of existing supply, and the flow is the amount of new production. When you have a ton of new production, the stock to flow goes really low, right? And you want it ideally to be very high, to where there's a lot of stock and just a little bit of flow, so it stays very high. And that's kind of, if you look at what Bitcoin has done, their stock to flow is, it started out as a ton of flow at the beginning, and then it has every 4 years. So it starts to take a lot longer for that flow to happen, whereas most other countries are doing the opposite, where they had a certain amount and now they're just, the US is printing $1 trillion or adding $1 trillion of debt every 90 days right now. So it's crazy how much the flow has changed these days compared to back when a lot of this stuff really happened.
Yeah, and you think about the gold stock to flow. Okay, I mentioned Aztecs and Egyptians. You know, based on the technology that they had, you know, pyramids and how they were built being excluded. But, you know, for them to mine gold, that gold's got to be pretty easy to get to. And so they're, you know, initially the flow of gold was through the roof. You know, they're built, they got pounds and pounds, like heavy golden statues and things like that. And, you know, over time, all the easy gold gets mined. And now it's harder and harder to mine the gold. And we're doing more advanced technologies and going underwater to mine gold and things like that. Well, all of the easy flow just built the stock so that now, even if the flow is greater in ounces, the stock to flow ratio isn't getting upset because you have so much stock. And on the Bitcoin side, same thing. For the first several epochs, the flow is through the roof, so stock's building quickly. And then what, you know, how it's built with the halvings, now the flow keeps decreasing, and this, but you built the stock quickly. And so it basically, you know, we're 15 years, 16 years since the beginning. It mimicked how gold worked over thousands of years, and they just compressed it so that it happened a lot quicker, but it still has the same feel of the stock to flow decreasing to get to. And honestly, your flow is going to get cut in half, but your stock is so large that it's not going to feel that different. I mean, we talk about it on podcasts all the time. It's like we're mining 450 Bitcoin a day, and the ETFs and MicroStrategies bought up 20,000 Bitcoin this week. So, you know, they're pulling that out of the stock. You know, that's not coming out of the flow.
Well, and if you look at the stock of Bitcoin in the first 15 years, they released more than 95% of the stock. So the next 100 years is going to take the remaining 5% of the stock to be mined, right? So, I mean, it was very front-end weighted from that perspective too.
And kind of take it back to the book and kind of how gold evolved, you know, because gold is valuable and if it's a bearer asset, right? So if you have gold and I take it from you, now it's my gold. Right. If you're a country and I bomb you and I take your gold, now it's my gold. And so on an individual basis, that's kind of the evolution of banks, and banks would hold the gold and they would write a note. So you'd have a bank note that says you have gold in the bank, and you could trade that much easier than you could gold coins or gold flakes or gold bricks or bars. And kind of that's, you know, that's how we brought in banks into this. And then governments and central banks kind of doing the same thing, holding the gold, saying they have it. And once they don't have to have it anymore because we're off the gold standard, that's when everything starts to shift, right? What WTF happened in 1971? Everything gets less productive per dollar as the dollar inflates. And honestly, there's a shift from low time preference in the previous hundreds and thousands of years where you're making great works of art and you're building things to last, and just things are getting faster and quicker and a lower time preference for everybody. And this is also where things shift too. And there's a quote in here that the government control of money has turned money from being the reward for producing value to the reward for obedience to government officials. And I'm like, I'm not anti-government. That's not fair. I'm anti-government corruption through the roof. I hate it. It sucks. It's one of the most frustrating things. But man, is that, to me, that sentence is super true. I grow up and I purposefully don't get involved with big business because it doesn't feel like you're rewarded for producing stuff. You're rewarded for doing financial games and tweaking things so that your EBITDA multiple goes up or your PE ratio goes up and everybody gets paid money, but nobody sold anything extra. The products didn't get better. All you did is you lowered your interest rate by 0.5% on all this debt. So your value went up. So your stock price went up and you didn't do anything. And so for me, I'm stuck in small business world where, hey, what kind of strategy do we need? Do we need a new product base? Do we need to go get new customers? Do we need to open a new branch? You're doing things and then you get rewarded for doing those things. There's value and then you get money for it. And I'm like, I thought I wasn't a very simple person, but I'm, when it comes to this stuff, I just hate that people get rewarded for playing games instead of actually providing value. And now we see it a lot with what Elon's doing with Doge, that if you could get buddied up with some government officials, you can get paid for doing nothing. Right? I mean, you can literally just grift your way into being wealthy because you're friends or you're connected to the government. And I don't want to turn this into like a rant, but it's freaking true. And you couldn't do that on the gold standard because they're not going to pay for these crazy $75,000 toilet seats if they have to actually pay the money in gold and have to have the assets to back it. But if they print the money, man, who cares? We'll do a $1 trillion bill, whatever's in there, but it's in there. It's just a cost of doing business. And then 30% of that money just goes into people's pockets because they lie, cheat, and steal their way into some government contract. And there's no accountability. When there's gold backing everything, everybody's accountable because you can't lie about the gold. You have it or you don't. And if we ever get to a Bitcoin standard, it's the same boat, except for you don't have to tell me that your gold is in Fort Knox. I can go on the internet and I can type in your address and I can see the Bitcoin that's in your vault. I don't have to trust that it's in your vault. I can verify that it's in your vault. And so, you know, not to jump ahead, but, you know, in the book, we haven't talked about Bitcoin yet. You know, we're still on basically explaining why the gold standard existed. But holy crap, man, like what a different world it would be to live in. And for some of these people, and my stepfather, he's 71, and I talked to him. I was like, how crazy was it when Nixon lifted the gold standard? He was like, it was wild. But he said it was a wild time. All these things were happening, 60s and 70s. You know, it was nuts. But for me, you know, it's kind of a history lesson. It could have happened 200 years ago. It could have happened 50 years ago. It doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is that what you're looking for is a free market, right? And with what has happened, there's not really a free market anymore. Bitcoin theoretically helps enable that. There's a lot of, I think this talked about in the Fiat Standard, which is his follow-up book, which might be worth us diving into that in the future at some point too, to kind of talk about some of the things that the Fiat Standard has done for or forced on us from its entire history as well. But yeah, if we could get to a true free market where things are paid for if they actually bring value, then that would be ideal.
Yeah, and so this is right where the book talks about some of the fiat standard stuff. Once you're off the gold standard, you know, how money influenced family life, innovation, art, universities, you know, everybody moves into a more high time preference lifestyle. And so you're, you know, what's the point of making long-term beautiful things if you know the money's just falling apart? And so, you know, we go into like, he goes into the Keynesian economics. It's all about spending everything. You know, if you have a recession, then you got to print money, or you do government spending. You either print money and hand it to people so they spend it, or you spend it yourself from the government. The other philosophy is you lower taxes, but Keynesians don't like that, because some people will save that money, which is in Keynesian terms bad for the economy. And so you go through all this stuff and you're like, man, the more these people had these theories about how things should work with economies and money flow, instead of just letting gold back trade and be the money, the more things fell apart. And if, you know, the more I'm not a history guy, I find it kind of annoying, but the more I learn about it, the more it feels like there's just this pendulum and it moves from one side to the other. And so the gold standard was on one side and then it swung to this fiat standard where governments are printing as much money as they want and it's going to swing back. I mean, I think Lawrence Lepard says it, there's a theory that if something can't go on forever, then it has to end. And this government spending and deficit growth and debt can't go on forever. I don't know how long it can go on, but it can't go on forever, so it has to end. When it ends, what are they going to do? They have two choices as far as I can see it. They go back to the gold standard or they go to a Bitcoin standard. It's it's going to be after 2025. So gold standard seems like an antiquated way to do it. More and more people like me and are being convinced that Bitcoin could do it. And so, you know, for me, you know, it talks about zombie companies, right? These companies that basically take on debt to make payroll. They're not keeping up with inflation. I mean, if your company is growing at 5% and inflation's at 7%, right? You grew at 5%. It looks like you're making money. You're not. You're losing 2% a year. You're actually dead, and you're just a zombie. And so that can't go on forever, right? Something's going to happen. You're going to hit a recession, or interest rates go up, and that debt can't be rolled over. And now you're not a zombie anymore. Somebody put a bullet in your head, and now you're actually just a dead body. So that's some of these zombie companies have been walking around for decades, you know, because they can play the game on fiat money. If it was gold standard, they wouldn't. So if everybody's got to have the gold, guess what? You're not taking flyers on crazy startups that have no chance. But if money's easy, you're putting money all over the place and just placing your bets, because if one takes off, all the losers get paid for it. And you don't have to have the gold. You just get financed at 2% and 3%. You know, it's like Michael Saylor. He's borrowing money at 0%. Why not? What a great idea. Go buy Bitcoin and all you got to do is print more shares of stock. I mean, he's using dollars and shares to buy Bitcoin. So he's using things that are printed, things that he prints himself, to buy stuff that can't be made by anybody. It's like going from houses to MicroStrategy stock to Bitcoin. You know, it's going from softer to harder money. Like, to me, if you read this book, if it's the first book you read when you get into Bitcoin, it's valuable. If you come back to it 5-6 years later, it pulls together a lot of the stuff that you listen to in podcasts, and it's pretty, I found it to be pretty valuable to reread.
Yeah, I agree. It's one of those things where there's so much to the ecosystem in Bitcoin. And shoot, you and I, we wrote a book about the same time the Bitcoin standard came out, right? Just trying to understand what was happening in this space. And I even watched The Hidden Secrets of Money, which is by a guy that kind of did something similar, but just focused on what the fiat dollar is, how it's created and how it's done. And I mean, the more you learn about this, the more you're like, ah, okay, this makes more sense. This is why something like Bitcoin can be successful based on what's happening in the real world with fiat dollars. So it's definitely worth $15, whatever it is, to buy the book.
Oh, no doubt. To me, if you don't understand Bitcoin, this book's great, because it's not in your face about Bitcoin. Yeah. It really walks you from not knowing about the history of money and understanding money. When you try to learn about Bitcoin, you have to first learn about money. And this does a great job of walking you from, you know, the early stuff, the barter system, all the way through to how, especially if you're, I mean, the thing is, if you were born under the gold standard, you're probably too old to even care about Bitcoin. So this book it's got to be built for people that have only lived in a fiat standard. So you got to fill in a lot of blanks, right? I mean, we grow up, inflation is just part of it. 2% inflation, you know, until COVID, nobody was looking at CPI every month, like, wait, what is it going to be? Like, nobody's doing that crap. Like, it would pop up every once in a while, very rarely, that they would talk about inflation. But again, you can't just print money and not impact inflation. And that's what happened. You know, COVID was a wild time, printing tons of money and then thinking that inflation was transitory. You know, it's just crap, right? Like, it's just the longer this goes, the further we get from the gold standard, the more it's just garbage information. And like, you're just rewarded for playing the government games. And the book actually mentioned that universities have gotten worse because professors don't teach as much, and they spend a lot of their time doing research so that they can get government grants, so that they can write papers that nobody reads, that's just garbage, but it's how they get money. And the government just prints the money, so there's no value there. It, you know, if it was gold backed, then the research would all be valuable because you wouldn't want to waste your gold on crappy research that doesn't have any bearing on improving the world. And it's like, man, that makes sense. Like this, it's, and when you look at the cost of college tuition, government backed, right? So yeah, the government will back a loan. Who cares? If something happens, the government just prints money, pays off the loan. Like, why wouldn't the government back those loans? But what it does is just throws money into the system and it incentivizes colleges to raise their tuition and be more expensive, because even if every single student defaults on their loan, they still get paid. So why not go out and try to get paid more? So it is a good walk through history to get in and understand gold. And then it does touch on how fiat, writing the fiat standard was smart, because there's a, you know, from the 70s to present, there's a lot to talk about. And, you know, this book it's not the goal of this book to dive into it, but man, it's super interesting. And when you kind of think about your own life, now you start to feel it. The older stuff, the 1700s through the 1900s, is interesting to look at and all that, but it's a different world. But, you know, when you get into understanding, you know, the closer you get to the money printer, the better you are, and you're incentivized to do that, then that's where the value is. So to me, this book's super worth reading. And then it starts to get into Bitcoin, because it's really established the gold standard and why it's important that everybody has a money that is, it can't be messed with, right? It can't be influenced by the government. So then it goes into explaining Bitcoin. This is where I really sped through it, because it's not super technical, which I liked, because I think that turns off a lot of people from Bitcoin trying to understand mining, and they get bogged down in like all these kind of technical pieces, which really aren't that important for most, if not, I would say most people that aren't already into Bitcoin don't care about the technical background of mining and nodes and everything. But from a high level, understanding how it all comes together to secure the network and the nodes allow everyone to transact without a third party allowing them to, they can do it themselves. That's valuable. Understanding the 21 million cap and the halving cycles and how Bitcoin enters the network, I think that's valuable. And so there's one thing that he touched on that I thought was good for people that aren't technical, and that was explaining how Bitcoin's exchanged. When you send a Bitcoin from one person to another, you're actually losing control over it and giving control over it, where people send an email and they're not sending that picture to their mom. They're copying the picture onto another computer. You don't, when you email that picture, you had one picture and you had it, and now you have two pictures. You have a copy and they have a copy. If that was Bitcoin, when you emailed it, you would no longer have your copy. There would only be that one. And I was like, man, that's not a bad way to get people that aren't very technical to understand how Bitcoin works. That it's, you know, forget mining and nodes and difficulty adjustment and forget all. If you had something that you valued and you wanted to trade it with somebody and you emailed it to them and then you didn't have it anymore. At that, to me, was like, huh, okay, that might be a way to explain it to people that have zero interest in learning the technical background of Bitcoin. But he does go into a pretty good, you know, he spends maybe a chapter or so on the Bitcoin network and how it ties together and all that, which I found to be kind of a remedial course in Bitcoin technology for me. I'm deep into this crap. So, but for other people, I think it was a very readable version of how a Bitcoin network works.
To me, I think the bigger issue for a lot of people is understanding the value that Bitcoin brings. And I think what this book does is give you that background you need to understand the value. And then at the end, he talks a little bit about, okay, well, how does the Bitcoin network work? And this is how, and that's important to know if you're going to invest in it at some point. But getting to that point takes a lot of education as well before you jump into there.
Yeah. And I thought it was great because, you know, the book's called The Bitcoin Standard. It spends most of the time walking you into the gold standard. And then it spends a little bit of time explaining to you why Bitcoin is likely better than gold and will likely be adopted instead of gold. You know, once this thing that can't go on forever ends and we move to something else, here's why Bitcoin works. you know, that you can go from US dollars up into Bitcoin and then back down into the euro, right? And you can do it easy, quickly, verifiably. You know, it talks about like, yeah, you can't, you know, the number of transactions, and it's limited, and, you know, kind of goes into scaling late, like at the end in the Q&A. But from a big, large scale standpoint, this Bitcoin can replace, like, we went from the gold standard, we removed gold. Bitcoin can slide into the role that gold had. It can do a better job than gold did. And so I think that's how we got to the Bitcoin standard, is, hey, we were on the gold standard. Now we're on a fiat standard. The next step would be the Bitcoin standard. And I to me, great book. I mean, I've read it twice now, and where I was reading it and where I am now reading it, I got very different things from it. I mean, you know, I felt like it was something, you know, for me, I'm no expert, right? I'm Seyfeddin Amos is a mechanical engineer turned economist. I'm a mechanical engineer turned generalist. You know, I like to learn stuff. The stuff that benefits me the most, I like a lot, because, you know, the more I learn about Bitcoin, it seems like the more my net worth goes up, and I like that. But, you know, one of the things that the book talked about, you know, was self-interest and the spontaneous emergence of monetary order. So when government or people create something or design something, that's not as good as when humans act and then something emerges through technology and human action and self-interest. So to me, the way Bitcoin is going, it's definitely in people's self-interest. It's technology forward. You know, it's not, you know, it's better than gold from a technology standpoint. So if you look at like what's next, then it's hard to argue that Bitcoin isn't next. So that's to me where Seyfeddin did a good job of connecting the dots, but did it in a way to not turn off people that aren't into Bitcoin. You know, like, it's a great book for me. I know a lot about Bitcoin, and now I know a lot about money. But for somebody who's, you know, been working 60 hours a week since they were 18, and now they're 45, they got just enough time to read a book. Like, this is not a bad book to read if you're going to evolve from working your tail off, getting a 3% cost of living raise, inflation's going up by 7 to 12% a year. And before you're drowning, you got enough time to read a book. This would be a good book to read.
Well, I think that may be a good place to kind of end on. I mean, we recommend the book for sure. I think we both enjoy it. Maybe in the future, we'll take a look at the fiat standard and talk more about that and expand upon what's been talked about in this book so that people can understand a little bit more about why you and I believe there's got to be something after the fiat standard, right? Because I don't think it can continue to go the way that it's going. So we'll try to figure out a good time to do that in the future and do a part two.
Yeah, the fiat standard is definitely the next book I read.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Hal, thanks for doing this. This was awesome. And we'll catch up next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jason.
If all of these crypto conversations leave you with more questions and you're looking for answers, I've created a product that dives into most of those answers, including why crypto, how to set up a cold wallet, and some of the more advanced strategies for dealing with crypto. Check the link in the notes below, and hope to see you there.